This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. After a week in which stoppage time goals in several games left some supporters wishing they hadn't gone home early, particularly at the Valley, where there were four, brackets F-O-U-R, after 90 minutes. A Charlton Athletic came from two down for a second time in the match to draw with Ipswich Town. It's 2 years in his job that our first guest is celebrating.
It's gone very quickly, first of all. We were talking about it this morning, but I think as we get of advancing years, I think time goes quicker anyway.
We'll also talk EFL youth development.
The whole recognition of player care has been really important, and this has really come to the fore over the last two or three years.
And a Football League legend has got designs on what we're eating.
So whatever we put in our body affects us on a day-to-day basis.
It's the official EFL podcast. Let's start this episode in Sky Bet League 2, where it has just passed 2 years in charge of Mansfield Town for Nigel Clough. Let's get the challenging stuff out of the way first of all, Nigel, because unlucky for us, we managed to book you to come on after one of those weekends. And I guess I wanted to ask you, after approaching 25 years as a manager, does it get any easier to have one of those freaky results?
No. It actually gets a little bit tougher, if anything.
Does it? It hurts you even more, does it? It still hurts you exactly the same? No coping mechanism to deal with those to quickly process it?
No. Just time and the next match. That's the only thing, because you know you've got another match within a week, sometimes 4 days. So you have to get over it. Or try to, but it still lingers. You pick the bones out of it and you analyse it and everything and you go over it and then you move on to all intents and purposes, but it's still at the back of your mind. You lose five, you know, we've conceded 8 goals in a week. That doesn't go away very quickly. I think when we talked about coming on, I think we were 7 unbeaten. So I think it's something to do, you've jinxed us. We've just gone 3 in a week.
Don't start that, for goodness sake. So I think we had this conversation last year, because at this time last year, I think you'd won 10 out of 11, but off the back of 14 without a win. Sometimes in football, do things happen, Nigel, that we just can't quite put our fingers on? We just don't know why something has happened.
Without doubt. That's just football. I think in the last 2 weeks, Liverpool season, and football can be encapsulated within that 2 weeks. To go to bottom of the league, Forest, and lose 1-0, which nobody saw coming. Then in the week, they go and win 3-0 at Ajax, and then they go and lose to another bottom three side in the last minute at home at Anfield. It's called football, and that's all it is. And that's one of the reasons I think that so many people are captivated by it at times, annoyed by it at times, frustrated by it. Because you just really, even that, you just can't tell what's going to happen. Yeah, it's predictable in a lot of ways, and especially the Premier League these days, but it still throws up the odd surprise, which amazes everybody.
How do you reflect on your 2 years with Mansfield?
It's gone very quickly, first of all. We were talking about it this morning, but I think as we get of advancing years, I think time goes quicker anyway. Seriously, it does.
You
goes
can
quicker.
Say that again. You can absolutely say that again. Yeah.
When you're 25 or 35 or something, you know, 2 years seems to go quite slowly. But when you're getting on a bit, it seems to fly by, and that's what's happened in the last 2 years. It's felt like honestly about a year or something. But it's been incredibly. I think generally it's been good, very good. We've gone from sort of bottom six to top six. Which is progress. And one of the nicest and most rewarding things is the supporters have come back. We broke record season ticket sales in the summer by a considerable distance. The crowds were getting nearly double of what they were. And there's been a sort of re-engagement, I think, from the supporters and the connection between the supporters and the club and the players. I think that's been as good as anything.
Do you think it's getting harder and harder to find a club with the right owners as well out there who kind of get the big picture and will take some satisfaction out of the sort of movement you've just described, repositioning within a division, extra bums on seats, as opposed to this all-out splather for constant results?
Well, it seems to be that, but then again, you'll get the examples where people say, "Oh no, teams managers now are getting sacked when they're in good positions," and then the excuses will come out. Oh, it's not just all about results; it's about how we're playing. It's about the DNA of the football club and things like that. So, I wish they'd make up their mind which one it is. Is it results at any cost, or is it something more than that? Is it the bigger picture? Are you bringing youngsters through? Are the fans coming back through the turnstiles? Which is it? Is it part a bit of everything? But you can't have it both ways. You can't say, you know, it's just results, and then you get rid of a manager when they're getting reasonable results. So I think the brief should be clearly defined a little bit more. But in terms of, you look through football now and good owners, bad owners and everything, it is more difficult. But everybody, you know, owners put, especially ours, have put a lot of money into the club over the years. And they want to see some return for it, and they're entitled to see some return for it.
Yeah, but those parameters that you described, you agreed them with John and with Caroline Radford, did you?
No, we didn't go into that much detail. It was just come in, try and sort things out, and try and get us at the other end of the table. I think it's very difficult to be that definitive when you're going to a new job and sort of just nailing everything down to that degree. You've got to start winning football matches, and then you hope everything comes from there.
I mean, you know, when you've been in and around football for as long as you have, do you sort of look on your phone on a Monday lunchtime and there's the latest managerial casualty? Are you as bewildered as those of us in the media are, as a lot of supporters will be out there as well? Can you quite believe the turmoil out there?
Yes and no, still surprising, but you do become sort of numb to it, unfortunately, and you're not surprised. I mean, it's second halfway through October, 25% of the managers in League Two had changed, you know, and yes, there was a few down the bottom, but they weren't all, and then you see throughout the leagues. I think everybody's so frightened from each division of getting relegated, first and foremost. That's the Premier League as well. The financial penalties of being relegated are absolutely massive. So that panic sets in there in the Premier League. And then it just spreads throughout the leagues, I think. And once one or two go, it's then like the domino effect, isn't it? So who's going to be the first one? And then several will follow after that. But yeah, you still get surprised by it, and the timing of it, and the reasons given, and so on. You know, Rob Edwards, you know, had a fantastic season at Forest Green and then has 12 games at Watford. And the owners actually come out, at least they're honest, and said, "We think he's had enough time. Out of that, you know, 12 games, 3 months, that's enough time now. If that's going to be the benchmark, we're all in trouble."
When you hear somebody like Michael Beale, who I think sort of post turning down the Wolves job to stay at QPR, said one of the things that put him off was the potential upheaval. Can you relate? Because you always strike me as the sort of person that's kind of very comfortable in their own skin enough to choose the opportunities that fit with life as well. And I think sometimes with managers, we just, and probably players as well, we just expect people to up sticks and completely go to the other end of the country without imagining the practical infrastructure that's needed to grill your bacon and wash your socks, you know?
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a fallacy. I think in terms of, I've applied for jobs at the other end of the country and never had the opportunity. The opportunities that have come happen to have been where they've been, and the timing and so on. So I don't think you can choose, be that choosy in football. I think maybe half a dozen managers can. At the top level, but after that, if you're lucky enough to get a job, you take it wherever it is. When I was a bit younger, when the children were small and I stayed at Burton and everything, maybe a little bit different then when they were growing up, but certainly in the last 10 years or so, I've applied for jobs when I've been out to work away from the Midlands.
Okay. Well, thanks for clarifying that. Remiss of me not to sort of work that out, or for us to have had that conversation privately, so I wouldn't have asked you that question. Just a few, I think, real benchmarks this weekend. Nathan Jones, 300 games in charge of Luton Town. It takes some doing that, Nigel, doesn't it?
It does, in a couple of spells, but it still takes some doing. And it's a perfect example where he had an opportunity to go to, no disrespect to Luton, a bigger club with bigger resources in Stoke. And you know, it didn't work out, and he's gone back to Luton, got them in the playoffs last year. Sometimes there's just a fit, you know. And no matter what happens and how hard you try, things just don't work out at a certain club for certain reasons. And it's again when you ask, you know, why and certain things, it's just football. It just doesn't work out. You know, Steve Bruce has just left West Brom. He's got, I think, the most promotions on his CV. Sometimes it's just not the right fit, not the right time, not the right players, and not the right feel at the club. And then a different person can come in, all of a sudden the team and the squad look at a different entity altogether. So I think there's a lot of something, you know, the right place, the right time has a lot to do with.
And it says something as well, doesn't it, that Gary Rowett's just celebrating 3 years in charge at Millwall, and that's seen as like a major achievement in the current era.
It certainly is in the Championship and in the Football League, yes. You know, I think what's the average tenure now is, what, 13 months, something like that. So anything you get over that really is a bonus. And I know a lot of managers view the sort of always one have one eye almost on the next job. And you can understand that in a certain way. You have to concentrate everything and give everything. But you're more than aware that you're a few games away from being out of work.
Yeah, there's a couple of other big numbers I wanted to throw at you. Tony Mowbray, 800 games as a manager. That is magnificent. I don't think people realise or give enough kudos and credit for an achievement like that, Nigel.
Nope, not at all. And I was very surprised when he left Blackburn in the summer, having taken them from League One up to promote sort of playoff challenging with Blackburn, and wonderful that he's got another great club in Sunderland. So I think they're very lucky to have such a very good experienced manager.
Yeah, and we got to mention Dean Lewington, haven't we? 900 career games. Did you actually play against him at any stage as you were sort of player managing towards the end of?
No, I played. He was obviously a player when as I was managing, but no, I don't think I played against him. He's old, but not that old.
Well, mate, but I mean, what about that though? I mean, yeah, he's coming incredible. Up to 20 years as a professional footballer. It's magnificent.
It is. The number of appearances as well, to stay injury free for that long and still be playing and still have, you know, the appetite and the hunger. It is an incredible achievement. Incredible. You know, there's not many players. I think it's still 800 games as a manager. Tony Mowbray still supersedes it somewhat because life as a manager is a little bit more difficult than that as a player.
One more from the weekend. 4-4 draw between Charlton and Ipswich. Magnificent game, late goals. A couple of times a whistle from the crowd stopping play. I mean, how frustrating from a manager's point of view.
I thought that had gone out years ago.
But I guess there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. But as a spectacle, how ruinous.
It is one of the things. It's such a simple thing for a spectator to do, but it can cause so much havoc. And you hope the people around him, whoever's doing it, you hope they identify him. I was going to say whistleblower then, but I don't think we can say that.
I see what you've done there. Listen, FA Cup this weekend, is that a welcome intrusion for you as you head to Barrow, or would you rather be head down getting on with the league?
Probably head down getting on with the league, but the FA Cup was such a wonderful tradition. I can never see it as a distraction. We always want to try and get through. I think when you're in non-league, you're looking for the first round draw, because then you're in with League One and League Two clubs, a lot of big clubs in League One. And then when you get in the league, you're trying to get to the third round, so you're in with the real big boys then. So you've got to get through and go to Barrow or anywhere else as difficult as that. We've just been there in the league 4 or 5 weeks ago, so we know how tough it is. But when you're down to the last two balls in the bag as we were, and Alan Smith, next time I see him, pulls Barrow out first, we could have done with being at home. For our supporters as much as anything, and it would have been, I know, a tough trip for the Barrow fans, but I'm more interested in our supporters. And you know, we've just been to Barrow four or five weeks ago, Crawley a couple of weeks ago, and now we're back up to Barrow again. So in this current climate, it's a big ask.
Yeah, get yourself a good book, eh? Get yourself a good book. Now, listen, last thing I wanted to discuss with you was World Cup is looming. Lots of focus on the Premier League and Championship, where we've got the penultimate round of fixtures coming up this weekend, and then the final round will be the weekend of Saturday the 12th. Have you Have you even thought about what it's going to be like to carry on playing whilst the world's greatest football tournament is going on? You carrying on in Leagues 1 and 2 playing domestically, I mean.
No, not giving it too much thought. The only thing I did cross my mind was a hope that it increases the attendances for League 1 and 2 and also lower down in the pyramid as well. I think people will still want to watch football in the weeks that it's on, and I hope then they can schedule in a game to the local club, either non-league or in League 1 or 2, and come and see them and experience a different sort of game than if you just go to the Championship or the Premier League games. I hope that's the most positive effect we have, because there's a lot of folk. Premier League is, you know, the be-all and the end-all and everything, and everything sort of filters down from there. Championship to a lesser degree. But I think it's a real good opportunity. You know, the World Cup games will be on most days, but it's a real good opportunity, I think, for League One and Two and below that to be highlighted as well.
Are you expecting your players to be distracted? Are you expecting you and your backroom staff to be distracted by, you know, one eye on Uruguay against South Korea and the other eye on making sure the lads have finished their set piece preparation for the game the day after?
Not in the slightest. We have a couple of Irish players in our squad who've never mentioned cricket before the previous week. Strange that when Ireland beat England, but I don't think they'll be distracted. If you ask most of our players, and I think modern day players, they wouldn't even know we're playing in a week or two's time. So I don't think they'll know too much about the World Cup.
All right. Well, listen, I'm suddenly realizing that I picked those two teams off the top of my head. I hope Uruguay and South Korea are in the World Cup. If they're not, I've probably just made a fool of myself, but I'm prepared to take the hit. Nigel, congratulations. Just keep chipping away. It's those little increments of progress, isn't it? It's just keep putting that extra bit of sugar in the bowl and moving towards the ultimate objective, which I guess is to get Mansfield maybe one stage better than you went last season.
That's the plan. If we can do it, it's a big ask, because there's many years since I think they were in the League One. In League One, it probably wasn't even League One then. But we'll keep trying. We think we've improved since last year, but we've got to prove that.
Great to talk to you. Really appreciate you joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And what do you know, folks? Producer Dave has just told me that Uruguay and Korea Republic, to give South Korea their official name, are indeed in the same World Cup Group H. FA Cup then this weekend, the 48 League One and League Two clubs joining the remaining 32 non-league clubs in round one. I've just picked out three here, but I'm sure you'll go through the fixtures yourself. Hereford, Giant Killers, most famously against Newcastle in 1972, now in the National League North. They entertain Portsmouth, 1949 and 2008 winners. That's your Friday night game. I've picked out a 3 o'clock from Saturday. That's Lincoln City, 2016-17. Of course, became the first non-league club for 103 years to reach the quarterfinals. They travel to National League South, Chippenham Town. And then on Sunday, another National League North team, Curzon Ashton, they entertain Cambridge United, who, of course, beat Newcastle United in round three last season, but not in brilliant form, lost six of their last seven in the league. Between now and when we're back with the next episode of the Official EFL podcast, just one League One game. It's midweek next week, so that's after the FA Cup fixtures, and that is Shrewsbury Town against Oxford United. And there are four games in Sky Bet League Two. The leaders, Leighton Orient, head to Wimbledon. Carlisle head to Harrogate. Nigel Clough's Mansfield Town entertain Bradford City, and Salford City head to Rochdale. There is, however, a full round of Sky Bet Championship fixtures this coming weekend. It's the penultimate round before the World Cup comes to town. Friday night, that is Reading against Preston. Then on Saturday, early kickoff to the promotion favourite Sheffield United and Burnley play each other. It's Blackburn against Huddersfield, QPR at home to West Brom, Norwich travel to Rotherham, Swansea at home to Wigan, and then there are eight games coming up in the following midweek.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
He made more than 500 appearances for Leeds United and Bradford City as a, well, it says on my script, no-nonsense central defender. I can probably get away with this as we're not in the same room. But these days, David Wetherill's priority is finding, developing and nurturing the next generation of talent as the EFL's head of youth development. Do you know what? I'm not sure I've ever asked you how you came to specialise in this role.
Yeah, it was after my playing career. I moved on to the coaching staff at Bradford. I had a year in the sort of first team environment, assisting Stuart McCall. And then, as was often the case, it was a shuffle of staff. And I was asked if I'd be interested in becoming academy manager, which I did. And I think within probably 2 or 3 weeks of taking that role, I knew that, you know, youth development was where I wanted to be rather than the first team environment. Really enjoyed the processes and you know, the long-term view of coaching and developing players at that time, if you like. So, yeah, I stepped in to become academy manager at Bradford. And then a few years later, this role, the current role, became available, and I applied and was fortunate enough to get it.
I wonder whether the fact you do openly embrace it and see it as your specialist area is the reason that you've had the success you have, is the reason that you applied for the job with the EFL and got it. Because I suppose there will be some in the game for whom youth development is something you do if you can't get involved in the first team scene. And that's no criticism of them, but it's just the merry-go-round of football in particular with all the managerial turmoil that goes on.
I think it's far from a criticism, because I think when we talk about youth development, we focus naturally on the players, and that's why the system is in place. But also, it develops so many staff that go on to work at the top end of the game, and you know, in that first team environment, that it's also about the staff development as well as the players. And it's something that's often overlooked when we talk about the benefits of the academy system to the first team environment.
Yeah, and I guess as well, you've got to be a certain sort of person, as you say, to be willing to not have the kind of shorter term buzz, or only have it in increments that might not be seen publicly, but to get your kind of personal satisfaction, what could be, Dave, way, way down the line.
Yes, each their own, isn't it? You know, even within the academy space, there's a real difference in specialisms and what just from a coaching perspective, and what people are suited to. You know, an under 9 coach has to have different attributes and a different approach, obviously, to an under 21s coach. So it's, as I say, what different personalities sue, how you want to view things. Some people obviously live for the buzz of Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock or a Tuesday night at 7:45, and it's about winning in that first team environment. Other people get job satisfaction through you know, different means, and as you say, that longer term view. But as I said, when I transitioned, I suppose, into the academy space from the first team environment, I'd been in that first team environment all my working life, and you know, I think it was a change and a refreshing change, and something I really enjoyed right from minute one.
I promise you, I'm not asking this on behalf of the EFL chairman Rick Parry or chief executive Trevor Birch. What do you do, David?
My role primarily, we have a team of regional managers who are out there supporting the clubs to improve, enhance their academy processes and operations. So the real fundamental part, I suppose, of my job is managing that department and the staff within that department to help and assist our clubs to get better and improve. And then there's we obviously have a strategic element to this. We work closely with the Premier League. The Premier League set the rules for the youth development system, but we work really closely with the Premier League to try and, you know, develop the system and enhance the system from a, if you like, a rules and operational perspective. So there's a strategic approach away from that direct club involvement as well, I suppose.
I mean, one of the great joys of the EFL, obviously, is the kind of regional diversity. So where are we? Carlisle, Sunderland, Gillingham, Plymouth, but also that clubs come in all different shapes, sizes, ambitions. I mean, I'm guessing you are dealing with everybody from those who almost want to say, oh, leave us alone, we know what we're doing, through to those who happily want to take as much information from you and be as involved with everything you've got going as is humanly possible.
Yeah, I wouldn't sure I'd put it in that diversity in terms of whether the clubs want us to help them or not, but definitely in terms of the different magnitude of club operations from a first team level that everyone will be aware of. We have that same level of diversity in the academy system. You know, and the systems align into four different categories, which partially at least is based on a club's ability to fund their own level of operation. So we deal with clubs right at category one, which is the highest level of expenditure, if you like, the most full-time staff, supposedly the best facilities, etc., right at the elite level of the game, right down through the leagues to the lower levels, if you like, of the academy system. And it just brings its own challenges. You know, that we have at first team level as well, there's a real difference in levels of operation. So, you know, we have to be very mindful of that in terms of the support we're giving clubs and the advice on you know, how we think they can improve, because we've got to contextualise it to that club's environment.
Listen, I don't think we're giving away any state secrets at this point. Obviously, the flow through rate is extraordinarily challenging. So, therefore, as the years go past, how big a part of your job, the job of the academies, is managing expectations? Because obviously those that do make it and go on to play at the very top level, I mean, it's untold riches, isn't it? But there's a heck of a lot that don't make it. So how much are you balancing pushing kids to be the best that they can be, encouraging them that some players will make it, but safeguarding the other side, which is a heck of a lot, won't, and will need to regroup and find a new direction for their lives?
Very much so. There's one thing we won't be able to change ever, and that's there'll be 11 starting places in 92 clubs come a weekend, and we're never going to be able to change that. I think one of the things that has changed substantially in the getting on 12 years that I've been involved in this job, and 15 years in youth development as a whole, is exactly that focus, Glenn, with the whole recognition of player care had been really important. And this has really come to the fore over the last two or three years. There's been a review. We always look to update the youth development rules year on year, and there's been a consistent focus on player care, if you like, through that time period, and we've come a long, long way in that time. And that's really been enhanced in the last couple of years through the most recent review of the academy system, which is, if you like, giving another boost to the player care aspect. And there's a lot of misconceptions around this in terms of, you know, what is available to players in the academy system. So, you know, provisions around education are just one example, whereas I think, you know, years and years ago, going back 20 years plus, then the academy system probably didn't have the provisions in place that it does now. But where a player misses some time in school, for example, now that club has to provide compensatory education. There's got to be minimum levels of tracking and monitoring of educational progression and liaison with the schools. Everything that's done is with the agreement of the schools and parents. So there's a lot of interaction there between the clubs and schools. And I think the message that's out there that's often portrayed about the academy system is that education suffers, if you like, which it doesn't need to now. You know, it shouldn't do. There are provisions in place. We had when we were setting up a lot of the player care provisions, we looked at the Tanny Gray Thompson duty of care review in sport from 2017, and rules are aligned to that, to try and take into account all the different aspects that were highlighted in that report. And I just talked about the boost that's been given in the last couple of years. I mean, probably the best example of that is that in all the clubs that operate from under nines, in all the academy clubs that operate across those age groups, there's a full-time head of player care in all those clubs now. So, you know, there's someone whose job is just to focus on the care of those boys who are in the academy system. And hopefully that'd be a real boost in terms of player welfare again moving forwards.
And would the modern day coach, that might be the first team coach, but also those that hold senior positions within the academy, is there an increasing push towards that holistic care? I would imagine an old school coach might have gone, don't worry about anything else. All you need to concentrate on is make sure that you give it your very best. If you really want to make it, don't look sideways or give yourselves other options. But is there more of a realism that so many won't make it now? And that's being reflected in the more holistic attitudes of coaches in general.
There's certainly a balance to be struck there, because to make progress in football, there has to be a focus on football. But there's no reason that should be at the detriment of other things in a young person's life. There's an aim in the academy system now that involvement in the system is a life enriching experience for all. It's not the many paying the price for the few that go on and make it. And I think one of the things from a coach specific perspective is that we have youth specific coach development programs now that not only take into account the technical and tactical elements of a player and a young person's development, but also the psychological elements and the social elements, to hopefully that you know, we get to a point where every player in the system, whether they go on to have a professional career or whether they leave after a couple of years, can look back at that time and say, yes, it was enjoyable, but in general, it was a life enriching. I had some great experiences. I learned a lot, and they can look back positively on it instead of you know, the perception that's out there in terms of it's negative for everybody else other than the ones that go on and have a long career. That's the aim for the system, and the aim of the provisions that that we've got established now.
I mean, it's a no-brainer, David, isn't it, that a club would want to produce its own talent. What do you say to a club that might be feeling a bit down in the dumps because they just haven't had the flow through, they're just not getting the talent through, whether it's to enrich their own first team or to enrich, then move a player on for a fee, which obviously helps to bankroll the club going forward? You must have a few at any one times that are just not quite getting any sort of numbers through. What do you do to help them?
Well, I think the first point now is to recognise that although there's a lot of media coverage about a few clubs that are not in the system, the vast majority of clubs are involved in the academy system. So, you know, there are positive things coming out of it, obviously, from that perspective. And not many clubs looking to sort of change that and drop out. But I think it's the core of our job, really, Clem. You know, we're there to help and advise the clubs on how to improve what they do and get players through and develop players. So it's the core of our job and our department's job to identify what the issues might be within a club. You know, where any blockages might be, where that club could improve with the resources that it has, to progress and maybe do things better, which will result in more positive outcomes. So, you know, I we like to think and we know that our team of regional managers who are out there working with clubs have a good understanding of what is going on in each academy and in a really good position to help and advise the club, the academy manager and an executive level as to the things that they might look at to get more players coming through their system.
And as we head towards the point where Gareth Southgate announces his World Cup squad, I just wonder how much pride we should all have at his current squad and all those connections to the EFL, whether it's time spent on loan with an EFL club, an actual a debut for a current EFL club, maybe a debut in an EFL Cup competition. Should we all feel pride in that bond?
I think so. You know, previous squads have shown a really high level of EFL involvement in the development of players in the circumstances that you outlined, and we'll obviously see what Gareth's final squad is. But you know, the odds are there'll be plenty of players in there who have spent some time in one way, shape or form with it within the EFL. One of the strengths, I think, we look at the first team game, people always talk about one of the strengths of the game being the pyramid that we've got in this country. And it's just the same in the academy system as well. And there are really good players being developed at all levels of the academy system and the game. And a number of the players who might be developed at, if you like, smaller clubs, go on and progress to careers right at the very top of the game. There are plenty of examples in the Premier League of that. So, you know, we'll see what squad is selected. But, you know, the expectation will be to follow the trend of previous squads, and there have been plenty of players there with EFL involvement. I think it's worth mentioning, Clem, as well, that the outcomes of players from EFL academies, the positive outcomes are improving, if you like. We've got a record high percentage of EFL academy players have come through the academy at that club. That's at 27% of the EFL professional population have come through the academy at that club. The appearances in the start 11 of club developed players, that's players who have been at a club for at least 12 months before the end of the under 19 season, so essentially academy developed players, that's been increasing season on season for the last five seasons. So we're at a record high of that. That's gone up 18% over that period of time. So we've seen a lot of positive outcomes in terms of players progressing into the first team environment with the EFL clubs at the minute.
Well, listen, well done with that. I mean, the key statistic though is, are we still producing no nonsense central defenders?
I was going to pick you up on that. Yeah, I'll take the no nonsense bit, I suppose. But yeah. It's not the most flattering comment I've had about my abilities, but I'll take it.
I'd just like to distance myself from it and wholeheartedly blame producer Dave for that. I took a week off and let him do a little bit of the scripting, and look what he does. I'll just have to retake the mantle, won't I? Keep up the fantastic work. It's always a pleasure, Dave.
Thanks. Pleasure to speak to you, Clem.
This is the official EFL podcast.
Our final guest on this episode started his playing career at Burnley before moving on to Bury, Shrewsbury Town twice, Hereford United, Bournemouth, where he was part of Eddie Howe's legendary team that took the club into the Premier League for the first time, and then QPR. He also had additional loan spells at Kidderminster Harriers, Luton Town and Hull City, a winger and attacking midfielder. He was one of that rare breed who played and scored in each of England's five nationwide top footballing divisions. But that's only part of Mark Pugh's story. He now works as an online health coach, keynote speaker, gym instructor, personal trainer, and a nutrition and life skills educator, better known to his tens of thousands of Instagram followers as the foodie footballer. I'm suddenly feeling like I want to shrivel quite small, Mark, because I've just had the week off to celebrate a rather big birthday. And if I say it involved three nights in Bologna in Italy, the food capital of Italy, you'll know why I'm feeling a little bit sheepish and embarrassed. Can you eat well but still have blowouts?
Yes, of course you can. 3 days is an absolute carb fest, though, over there, isn't it? There's a lot of pizza and pasta and that. But as I always say, balance is key in life. And if we focus on that 80, 90% good, and then we're allowed a little treat here and there. And if you've had 3 days, I'm sure you're back on the wagon this morning, and you've had a lovely, nutritious breakfast, haven't you?
Well, let me tell you and see if this is okay. I'm trying to be really good. I've been up very early today. And actually, let's level to the listeners of the Officially EFL podcast. We are, 11:30 in the morning we're recording this. I got up about 7:15. Did a little bit of mindfulness. I used the Headspace app. Did some calf stretches, little bit of a band over the top just to get the back muscles working. A few sit-ups and things. And then I allowed myself a Marmite crumpet at maybe about 8:15. But as we head towards lunchtime, I thought, I'm not going to get through this chat slavering over some of the food you're going to tell me about without. So I had another crumpet, this time with a bit of Marmite and then a thin sliver of peanut butter on top. Bearing in mind I've been up for 6.5 hours, is that reasonable, or have I already overeaten?
No, that's not enough food in my eyes. And It's very beige as well. There's not enough colour on that plate for me. You should get some eggs and protein down here as well. So,
can we talk about the point at which you realised you could still stay in the game, but taking a less usual route? A lot of guys obviously get on the coaching bandwagon and things, but you know, I listed that glorious portfolio of yours as we started.
No, thank you. Yeah, I mean, when I was 33, I decided to set up my Instagram page. I became really passionate at 26 years old about nutrition because the more I educate myself, I implemented it into my daily life. I felt better physically, mentally. I was taking my performances to the next level when I got promoted to the championship with Bournemouth. I went from running 11, 12K to 13 and sometimes close to 14K. So I knew the small percentages really did matter. So when I set up my Instagram page, I wanted to help inspire others, live a healthier lifestyle, help them with the fueling for performance and recovery as well. But not only that, I think athletes get caught up with fueling for just that one performance and not the season. Because at the end of the day, as we all know, the football season is grueling and it's 40 plus games every year. And we've got to keep on top of our health throughout that season. So rather than smashing loads of sugar down my body like I did in my earlier days, don't get me wrong, get quite well, but I focus on eating whole foods a lot more, eating a lot more complex carbs, and just making small changes, and it made a huge difference. So now I'm encouraging others. At 33, like I mentioned, set up my Instagram page. It got a real good response. A lot of people started engaging with me. And then, coming out of the game, I decided to retire. COVID was quite rife at the time and football fans weren't in the stadium. And the fans make it the beautiful game it is. And it made that transition a little bit easier for me because I had another passion in life. And, nutrition is a big, I'm obsessed with it, what I put in my body and helping others. So don't get me wrong, I do think back, I could have played till I'm 40. I feel physically great, to be honest. I feel better than I did when I was 22. But there comes a point where you've got to hang the boots up and there is life after football. I truly believe that.
Is there any doubt in your mind that you squeezed maximum vestige out of your body in terms of what you achieved as a result of those extra marginal gains of looking after something as integral as the foodstuffs you are putting in your body?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when we got promoted to the Premier League, especially because the athletes are next level, as you know, and to test yourself against world-class players, you've got to be able to run good distances, plenty of high-speed running, plenty of sprinting. And in my earlier days, I was struggling to recover for that Saturday-Tuesday game. On the Tuesday, I always felt quite lethargic, still tired, hadn't recovered properly. And that was because of what I ate over the weekend. As we know, people get to the weekend and we think, oh, we can get whatever we want in our body, we'll start again on Monday. Whereas as an athlete, you can't do that because if you eat poorly over the weekend, you've still got that buildup of inflammation come your training session Monday. You're going into that session Monday still with inflammation in the body, a bit sore. You train, you top it up again, and you don't recover properly for the Tuesday game. So, yeah, I mean, it made such a huge difference, not only for my recovery, but mentally as well. I wasn't going into games with brain fog, feeling a little bit lethargic. I know no matter what job you've got in life, the reality is if you eat poorly, you do have that brain fog and you feel like you're there with it, but you're actually not. I don't know whether you've ever felt that way.
Well, I want to pick up on the sort of is there an aspect of mental trickery here as well? That actually, I know that part of what you do is to promote well-being in terms of our mental health too. So if we do allow our guard to slip during maybe a period when we're trying to be as pure as possible, does it affect our state of mind? If I do suddenly go, oh, do you know what? There is a half-eaten big bag of crisp there. I'm going to have a few of those. And there's just that little flick of a switch in our heads that make us feel different about ourselves?
Yeah, 100%, because there's so much research coming out at the moment about the gut microbiome. So whatever we feed our gut microbiome, the effect it has on the body, whether it be with our brain, you know, if you put something high in sugar that goes straight into your blood, you're going to get that real sugar spike. You're going to be provided with energy for 30, 40 minutes. And then once that sugar, because the sugar gets out of in and out of your blood really quickly, you have what we call a sugar spike. And literally, you know, once you've hit top, you hit rock bottom just as quick, because these foods aren't providing your body with that long sustained energy. You know, the foods high in sugar. So whatever we put in our body affects us on a day-to-day basis. And I know personally, you need to get to know your body. And if I have too much gluten, if I have too much dairy, too much sugar, I know about it, because I feel around 2-3 o'clock, I hit a crash and I just don't feel fueled for the rest of my day. So it is so important. It really is.
Do you think us as the general public are hopelessly misinformed or ill-educated about the value of different foodstuffs? That, you know, you just mentioned healthy fats. When I mentioned peanut butter, I get very confused about carbs as well. You know, obvious ones, the pastas, the rices, the potatoes. But then, you know, I think I'm eating healthily if I go to the market and then come back and start chopping up peppers, leeks, courgettes, stuff like that, and sticking a bit of fish on top. But they're still, I suppose I'm being ignorant now in asking you that question, aren't I? Are we ill-educated, was my question, Mark?
No, it's a really good question, because the problem is a lot of misguided information out there. And one minute something's healthy for you, the next minute it can cause ill health. So you just never know where you are. But I try and simplify it for everyone. So if you're basing your meals, we'll speak a little bit about proteins, fats, carbs. If you're basing your meals around a healthy source of protein, so chicken, fish, turkey, a real lean source, like red meat, don't get me wrong, if you have a bit of red meat once a week, which I do, just to top up your iron, then really beneficial. But base your plate around a lean source of protein. Get plenty of complex carbs on your plate, such as your vegetables, your sweet potato, your quinoa, and like you touched on there, rice. So if we choose brown rice or whole grain rice over white rice, or whole grain pasta over white pasta, making small changes can make a huge difference. And then we speak about healthy fats. A lot of people get scared of eating healthy fats, but the reality is, they're called monounsaturated fats and polyunsaturated fats. So your avocados, your mixed nuts, your chia seeds, drizzling your extra virgin olive oil on your food afterwards, these are your real good fats. And we need to limit our saturated fats, such as your red meat, too much of it, your cheeses, your bacon, your sausage, your burgers, all the things that taste nice, basically. But just limiting them, it'll make you feel so much better. So if you base your meals around them.
You know, when you used to play, you're just about to kick off or something, you look in the crowd and somebody's eating a big fat pie or a hot dog spilling with sauces and stuff like that. Did your two worlds ever collide where you went, oh, goodness gracious me, that person's going to have a slump by the time we get into the second half?
You want to try and aim the ball for the hot dog or what have you, just to knock down your hand. But no, I agree with you, mate. I mean, the food at the stadiums are horrendous, and it's not cheap either. These football stadiums, you could get, you know, healthy food and charge a little bit more for it, and people will buy it because they'll feel so much better about themselves. I mean, your hot dogs, your burgers, your fries. I mean, we haven't touched on oils too much, but I mean, most restaurants and football stadiums, whatever it may be, they'll use the oil over and over and over again. And once you've heated an oil to a certain point, it can turn your food really, you know, bad for you if you keep using that oil over and over again. That's why I recommend to a lot of people, if you're going out for, say a steak or what have you, try choosing like your Mediterranean vegetables and a side salad with your steak, because these restaurants just make fries really unhealthy and give them a bad name. Whereas if you make chips or fries at home, in an oil that you haven't used over and over again, they can be actually quite healthy. You can air fry chips, fries, whatever we like to call them. It's just, again, the way grounds and restaurants serve the food, it just really frustrates me.
Do you know what? I'm just getting the vibe of when we had Henry Lansbury on a few weeks ago, who started his old gardening round. He got into cutting grass during lockdown and now actually has a van, scarifiers, aerators. And he's every bit as passionate about sort of lawn maintenance as you are about. You come on this podcast and start talking about gut microbiomes. Good Lord, what has the world come to? Over the course of your playing career, from sort of mid-2000s right the way through to, when did we finish again? We're talking about early 2021. You must have gone from the guy nobody wanted to sit next to on the bus to the guy everybody wanted to sit next to on the bus. I mean, there's a real sea change over that period in terms of that extra commitment to self and to health, was there not, amongst footballers?
Oh, everyone always wanted to sit next to me on the bus. Full
yeah,
of banter.
Right.
No, to be fair, it was always, especially towards the latter stage of my career, especially, like I said, when I 26, 27, and I started taking it really seriously. I did my diplomas in nutrition and my recent one's been in athletic performance and weight management. I always wanted to study, read books, and I was always taking a book on the coach. And yeah, I mean, I always got questions on health, nutrition. I turned up one morning and said to the chef at Bournemouth, I said, can you start getting the lad ginger shots, ginger and turmeric shots every morning? Great for recovery, great for the immune system, and will, you know, be a game changer. So then, you know, you get five lads trying it, and then next news you have 8 to 10. And it really does stick. So, yeah, just educating others around you, because at the end of the day, we were a team. I wanted to get the best out of my teammates and I wanted to perform well for them. So if you do it collectively, individually, then it can make a huge difference.
Absolutely fascinating. And this obviously ties into the work that you do now. So you do some work with the PFA. You go around club. Sorry, you do some work with?
So it's the EFL and the League Football Education.
Ah, and so they will set up for you to go round clubs and talk to the next generation of players to make sure they're ingraining decent habits straight away?
Yeah, so what it is, I'm on the Life Skills Programme, and basically the Life Skills Programme goes out to the 72 EFL clubs, and then they can request a booking from me. And it's had a really good response so far. I've got a lot of clubs booked in. I've been to visit a lot of clubs. And they get the option of listening through a long, grueling presentation from me. Actually, they've really enjoyed it, which has been nice. For 40 minutes, we'll do a Q&A after they can ask any questions they have for me. And then if the club want it and they have adequate facilities, we'll go and do a practical session in the kitchen as well. So we'll do some cooking. I'll teach them a lot about, you know, making slight swaps to make it a healthier meal, or, you know, make sure they are fueling themselves properly for games, recovering properly. And yeah, it's just been amazing. I've absolutely loved it. And it's like, obviously nothing replaces scoring a goal, but this is, it comes close to it, and I absolutely love trying to teach the next generation to get the best out of themselves.
Listen, we can't let you go without talking about those glory years at Bournemouth. Do you still pinch yourself a little bit? I mean, you joined the club in League One, so, you know, a season and a bit after they'd obviously had the struggles where they nearly dropped out of the Football League. But then just a few short years later to have been promoted to the Championship, then promoted to the Premier League. Do you still pinch yourself that fairy tale happened?
he was really special. I mean, to go through it as well with this pretty much the same group of lads from, you know, League One all the way to the Premier League, and then you're all playing in the Premier League together. It was special because we came from, you know, nothing basically. We were a hard-working bunch with some good quality. But my quote I always say all the time is hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. It's massive. We worked hard for each other. And yeah, I mean, it was surreal at the time, especially when you go back to our second season in League One. Eddie Howe left. And then when he came back from Burnley, we were sat 19th in League One. And then we went on a 20-plus unbeaten run to get promoted that season. So when you think back from where we were, it's absolutely incredible. And then to test yourself at the Championship, people told me I wasn't good enough for League Two, let alone the Championship. And then to score 9 goals that season in the Championship and, you know, get assists and, you know, be a part of an amazing story. It was just incredible. A lot of people say getting there is the easy bit. It's staying there for a long period of time. And we spent 4 years there and it wasn't a fluke. Whereas you see some yo-yo teams up and down, up and down. We proved that we deserved to be there, which was really special.
Yeah, I think the only thing is that very quickly football fans have a tendency to forget what happened even a decade ago and reposition their club in their heads and just take it for granted. Whereas, yeah, what you did was a very special moment. Okay, well, there's two final questions. We're going to have to finish on your ultimate health email. Otherwise, we'll undermine the whole chat that we've just had. But I need your guilty pleasure food-wise. What do you allow yourself to have as a treat? What do you allow yourself that kind of takes you to imbalance very occasionally?
Yeah, so if we go out for a Sunday roast or something and then there's a sticky toffee pudding and custard on the menu, I get sucked into it. So, yeah, sticky toffee pudding and custard. Very, very rare I have it, but I really enjoy it when I do. And at the end of the day, we can't beat ourselves up about it. It's a treat, and it's not like you do it every evening. So, yeah, sticky toffee pudding and custard.
Okay. And give me something that would be relatively easy for me to do tonight but would do my body the world of good if I had it on a kind of regular basis.
Yeah, so one of my favourite meals and my family's favourite meals is like a teriyaki salmon. So if you know, create a marinade with some ginger, garlic, chilli, sesame oil, soy and honey, that's your very simple marinade. Just coat it in your salmon, bang it in the oven for 10 minutes and that's your teriyaki salmon, absolutely beautiful. And then we like to serve it with like air fryer, crispy potatoes and like either roasted or steamed vegetables. So yeah, it's an absolute winner.
Wow. You honestly, I was going to thank you for coming on. I think I need a thank you for making me hungry again. My body's supposed to be a temple this week, instead of which I'm going to be going running off to the fridge straight away. It's been an absolute pleasure. Good luck with educating the next generation. Great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us on the official EFL podcast, Mark.
No, thank you for having me. Make sure you're getting some eggs on them crumpets as well to get that protein in.
Cheers, Mark.
Cheers, mate.
Well, there's some food for thought. See what I've done there? That's it for this episode. A big thank you to Mark Pugh, David Wetherill, and to Nigel Clough. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Join us again soon for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.